she stumbled, half fell, groping her way out, water drizzling from her stockings. She began to cry. Joe found her standing by the bowl. She had taken her wet, ruined suit off. She stood naked, supporting herself on one arm, leaning and resting.
"Jesus Christ,"
she said to him when she realized he was there.
"I don't know what to do. My jersey suit is ruined. It's wool."
She pointed. He turned to see the heap of sodden clothes. Very calmly, but his face was stricken, he said,
"Well, you weren't going to wear that anyhow."
With a fluffy white hotel towel, he dried her off, led her from the bathroom back to the warm, carpeted main room.
"Put on your underwear. Get something on. I'll have the hairdresser come up here. She has to. That's all there is."
Again, he picked up the phone and dialed.
"What did you get me in the way of pills?"
she asked, when he had finished phoning.
"I forgot. I'll call down to the pharmacy."
"No, wait.
I have something. Nembutal or some damn thing."
Hurrying to his suitcase, he began rummaging. When he held out two yellow capsules to her, she said,
"Will they destroy me?"
She accepted them clumsily.
"What?"
he said, his face twitching.
"Rot my lower body," she thought. "Groin to dry. I mean," she said cautiously, "weaken my concentration?"
"No, it's some AG Chemi product they give back home. I use them when I can't sleep. I'll get you a glass of water."
He ran off.
"Blade," she thought. "I swallowed it. Now cuts my loins forever. Punishment. Married to a Jew and shacking up with a Gestapo assassin."
She felt tears again in her eyes, boiling.
"For all I have committed. Wrecked."
"Let's go,"
she said, rising to her feet.
"The hairdresser."
"You're not dressed."
He led her, sat her down, tried to get her underpants onto her without success.
"I have to get your hair fixed,"
he said in a despairing voice.
"Where is that whore? That woman?"
She said, speaking slowly and painstakingly,
"Hair creates bear who removes spots in nakedness. Hiding. No hide to be hung with a hook. The hook from God. Hair here. Whore. Pills eating. Probably turpentine acid. They all met. Decided dangerous, most corrosive solvent to eat me forever."
Staring down at her, Joe blanched.
"Must read into me," she thought. "Reads my mind with his machine, although I can't find it." "Those pills," she said, "confuse and bewilder."
He said, "You didn't take them." He pointed to her clenched fist. She discovered that she still had them there.
"You're mentally ill," he said.
He had become heavy, slow, like some inert mass.
"You're very sick. We can't go."
"No, doctor,"
she said.
"I'll be okay."
She tried to smile. She watched his face to see if she had.
"Reflection from his brain. Caught my thoughts in rots."
"I can't take you to the Abinsons," he said. "Not now, anyway. Tomorrow. Maybe you'll be better. We'll try tomorrow. We have to."
"May I go to the bathroom again?"
He nodded, his face working, barely hearing her. So she returned to the bathroom. Again, she shut the door. In the cabinet, another blade, which she took in her right hand. She came out once more.
"Bye-bye,"
she said. As she opened the corridor door, he exclaimed, grabbed wildly at her.
"Whisk!" "It is awful," she said. "They violate. I ought to know. Ready for purse snatcher, the various night prowlers, I can certainly handle. Where had this one gone?"
Slapping his neck, doing a dance.
"Let me by," she said. Don't bar my way unless you want a lesson. However, only women.
Holding the blade up, she went on opening the door. Joe sat on the floor, hands pressed to the side of his throat. Sunburn posture.
Goodbye,
she said, and shut the door behind her. The warm, carpeted corridor. A woman in a white smock, humming or singing, wheeled a cart along, head down. Gawked at door numbers, arrived in front of Juliana. The woman lifted her head, and her eyes popped, and her mouth fell.
Oh, sweetie, she said. You really are tight. You need a lot more than a hairdresser. You go right back inside your room and get your clothes on before they throw you out of this hotel. My good Lord.
She opened the door behind Juliana.
Have your man sober you up. I'll have room service send up hot coffee. Please now, get into your room.
Pushing Juliana back into the room, the woman slammed the door after her, and the sound of her cart diminished.
Hairdresser lady, Juliana realized.
Looking down, she saw that she did have nothing on. The woman had been correct.
Joe,
she said,
they won't let me.
She found the bed, found her suitcase, opened it, spilled out clothes, underwear, then blouse and skirt, pair of low-heeled shoes.
Made me come back, she said.
Finding a comb, she rapidly combed her hair, then brushed it.
What an experience! That woman was right outside, about to knock.
Rising, she went to find the mirror.
Is this better?
Mirror in the closet door. Turning, she surveyed herself, twisting, standing on tiptoe.
I'm so embarrassed, she said, glancing around for him. I hardly know what I'm doing. You must have given me something.
Whatever it was, it just made me sick, instead of helping me. Still sitting on the floor, clasping the side of his neck, Joe said,
Listen, you're very good. You cut my aorta, artery in my neck.
Giggling, she clapped her hand to her mouth.
Oh, God, you're such a freak. I mean, you get words all wrong. The aorta's in your chest. You mean the carotid.
If I let go, he said, I'll bleed out in 2 minutes. You know that. So get me some kind of help. Get a doctor or an ambulance. You understand me?
Did you mean to?
Evidently. Okay. You'll call or go get someone?
After pondering, she said,
I meant to.
Well, he said. Anyhow, get them for me. For my sake.
Go yourself.
I don't have it completely closed.
Blood had seeped through his fingers, she saw, down his wrist. Pool on the floor.
I don't dare move. I have to stay here.
She put on her new coat, closed her new handmade leather purse, picked up her suitcase and as many of the parcels which were hers as she could manage. In particular, she made sure she took the big box and the blue Italian dress tucked carefully in it. As she opened the corridor door, she looked back at him.
Maybe I can tell them at the desk, she said. Downstairs.
Yes, he said.
All right, she said. I'll tell them. Don't look for me back at the apartment in Canyon City because I'm not going back there. And I have most of those Reichsbank notes, so I'm in good shape, in spite of everything. Goodbye. I'm sorry.
She shut the door and hurried along the hall as fast as she could manage, lugging the suitcase and parcels. At the elevator, an elderly, well-dressed businessman and his wife helped her. They took the parcels for her, and downstairs in the lobby they gave them to a bellboy for her.
Thank you,
Juliana said to them. After the bellboy had carried her suitcase and parcels across the lobby and out onto the front sidewalk, she found a hotel employee who could explain to her how to get back her car. Soon she was standing in the cold concrete garage beneath the hotel, waiting while the attendant brought the Studebaker around. In her purse, she found all kinds of change. She tipped the attendant, and the next she knew, she was driving up a yellow-lit ramp and onto the dark street with its headlights, cars, advertising neon signs. The uniformed doorman of the hotel personally loaded her luggage and parcels into the trunk for her, smiling with such hearty encouragement that she gave him an enormous tip before she drove away. No one tried to stop her, and that amazed her. They did not even raise an eyebrow.
"I guess they know he'll pay," she decided. "Or maybe he already did when he registered for us."
While she waited with other cars for a streetlight to change, she remembered that she had not told them at the desk about Joe sitting on the floor of the room needing the doctor. Still waiting up there. Waiting from now on until the end of the world. Or until the cleaning woman showed up tomorrow sometime.
"I better go back," she decided. "Or telephone. Stop at a payphone booth." It's so silly, she thought as she drove along, searching for a place to park and telephone. Who would have thought an hour ago, when we signed in, when we shopped? We almost went on, got dressed up, and went out to dinner. We might even have gotten out to the nightclub. Again, she had begun to cry, she discovered. Tears dripped from her nose, onto her blouse, as she drove. Too bad I didn't consult the Oracle. It would have known and warned me. Why didn't I? Any time I could have asked, any place along the trip or even before we left. She began to moan involuntarily. The noise, a howling she had never heard issue out of her before, horrified her. But she could not suppress it even though she clamped her teeth together. A ghastly chanting, singing, wailing, rising up through her nose. When she had parked, she sat with the motor running, shivering, hands in her coat pockets. "Christ," she said to herself miserably. "Well, I guess that's the sort of thing that happens."
She got out of the car and dragged her suitcase from the trunk. In the back seat, she opened it and dug around among the clothes and shoes until she had hold of the two black volumes of the Oracle. There, in the back seat of the car, with the motor running, she began tossing three RMS dimes, using the glare of a department store window to see by.
"What'll I do?" she asked it. "Tell me what to do. Please."
Hexagram 42. Increase. With moving lines in the second, third, fourth, and top places. Therefore changing to hexagram 43. Breakthrough. She scanned the text ravenously, catching up the successive stages of meaning in her mind, gathering it and comprehending.
Jesus.
It depicted the situation exactly. A miracle once more. All that had happened, there before her eyes, blueprint, schematic. It furthers one to undertake something. It furthers one to cross the great water. Trip. To go and do something important, not stay here. Now the lines. Her lips moved, seeking. 10 pairs of tortoises cannot oppose him. Constant perseverance brings good fortune. The king presents him before God. Now 6 in the third. Reading, she became dizzy. One is enriched through unfortunate events. No blame if you are sincere and walk in the middle and report with a seal to the prince. The prince. It meant Abinson. The seal, the new copy of his book. Unfortunate events. The Oracle knew what had happened to her. The dreadfulness with Joe or whatever he was. She read 6 in the fourth place. If you walk in the middle and report to the prince, he will follow.
I must go there, she realized. Even if Joe comes after me.
She devoured the last moving line, 9 at the top. He brings increase to no one. Indeed, someone even strikes him. He does not keep his heart constantly steady. Misfortune.
Oh, God, she thought. It means the killer, the Gestapo people. It's telling me that Joe, or someone like him, someone else, will get there and kill Abinson.
Quickly, she returned to hexagram 43. The judgment. One must resolutely make the matter known at the court of the king. It must be announced truthfully. Danger. It is necessary to notify one's own city. It does not further to resort to arms. It furthers one to undertake something. So it's no use to go back to the hotel and make sure about him. It's hopeless, because there will be others sent out. Again, the oracle says, even more emphatically,
get up to Cheyenne and warn Abinson, however dangerous it is to me. I must bring him the truth.
She shut the volume. Getting back behind the wheel of the car, she backed out into traffic. In a short time, she had found her way out of downtown Denver and onto the main autobahn going north. She drove as fast as the car would go, the engine making a strange throbbing noise that shook the wheel and the seat and made everything in the glove compartment rattle.
Thank God for Dr. Tott and his Autobahns, she said to herself as she hurtled along through the darkness, seeing only her own headlights and the lines marking the lanes.
At 10 o'clock that night, because of tire trouble, she had still not reached Cheyenne, so there was nothing to do but pull off the road and search for a place to spend the night. An Autobahn exit sign ahead of her read, Greeley, 5 miles.
I'll start out again tomorrow morning, she told herself, as she drove slowly along the main street of Greeley a few minutes later.
She saw several motels with vacancy signs lit, so there was no problem.
What I must do, she decided, is call Abinson tonight and say I'm coming.
When she had parked, she got wearily from the car, relieved to be able to stretch her legs. All day on the road, from 8 in the morning on. An all-night drugstore could be made out not far down the sidewalk. Hands in the pockets of her coat, she walked that way, and soon she was up in the privacy of the phone booth, asking the operator for Cheyenne information. Their phone,
thank God,
was listed. She put in the quarters and the operator rang.
Hello?
A woman's voice sounded presently, a vigorous, rather pleasant younger woman's voice. A woman, no doubt, about her own age.
Mrs. Abinson? Juliana said. May I talk to Mr. Abinson? Who is this, please?
Juliana said.
I read his book, and I drove all day up from Canyon City, Colorado. I'm in Greeley now. I thought I could make it to your place tonight, but I can't, so I want to know if I can see him sometime tomorrow.
After a pause, Mrs. Abinson said in a still pleasant voice,
Yes, it's too late now. We go to bed quite early. Was there any special reason why you wanted to see my husband? He's working very hard right now. I wanted to speak to him, she said.
Her own voice in her ears sounded drab and wooden. She stared at the wall of the booth, unable to find anything further to say. Her body ached, and her mouth felt dry and full of foul tastes. Beyond the phone booth, she could see the druggist at the soda counter serving milkshakes to 4 teenagers. She longed to be there. She scarcely paid attention as Mrs. Abinson answered. She longed for some fresh, cold drink, and something like a chicken salad sandwich to go with it.
Hawthorne works erratically,
Mrs. Abinson was saying in her merry, brisk voice. If you drive up here tomorrow, I can't promise you anything, because he might be involved all day long. But if you understand that before you make the trip...
Yes,
she broke in. I know he'll be glad to chat with you for a few minutes if he can, Mrs. Abinson continued.
But please don't be disappointed if by chance he can't break off long enough to talk to you or even see you. We read his book and liked it, Juliana said. I have it with me.
I see, Mrs. Abinson said good-naturedly.
We stopped off at Denver and shopped, so we lost a lot of time. No, she thought. It's all changed, all different. Listen, she said. The Oracle told me to come to Cheyenne.
Oh, my, Mrs. Abinson said, sounding as if she knew about the Oracle, and yet not taking the situation seriously.
I'll give you the lines.
She had brought the oracle with her into the phone booth. Propping the volumes up on the shelf beneath the phone, she laboriously turned the pages.
Just a second.
She located the page and read first the judgment and then the lines to Mrs. Abinson. When she got to the nine at the top, the line about someone striking him and misfortune, she heard Mrs. Abinson exclaim.
Pardon?
Juliana said, pausing.
Go ahead,
Mrs. Abinson said. Her tone, Juliana thought, had a more alert, sharpened quality now. After Juliana had read the judgment of the 43rd hexagram, with the word danger in it, there was silence. Mrs. Abinson said nothing, and Juliana said nothing.
Well, we'll look forward to seeing you tomorrow, then,
Mrs. Abinson said finally.
And would you give me your name, please?
Juliana Frink, she said.
Thank you very much, Mrs. Abinson.
The operator now had broken in to clamor about the time being up, so Juliana hung up the phone, collected her purse and the volumes of the oracle, left the phone booth, and walked over to the drugstore fountain. After she had ordered a sandwich and a Coke, and was sitting smoking a cigarette and resting, she realized with a rush of unbelieving horror that she had said nothing to Mrs. Abinson about the Gestapo man, or the SD man, or whatever he was, that Joe Cinadella she had left in the hotel room in Denver. She simply could not believe it.
I forgot, she said to herself. It dropped completely out of my mind. How could that be? I must be nuts. I must be terribly sick and stupid and nuts.
For a moment she fumbled with her purse, trying to find change for another call.
No,
she decided as she started up from the stool.
I can't call them again tonight. I'll let it go. It's just too goddamn late. I'm tired, and they're probably asleep by now.
She ate her chicken salad sandwich, drank her Coke, and then she drove to the nearest motel, rented a room, and crept tremblingly into bed. 14. Mr. Nobusuke Togomi thought,
There is no answer, no understanding, even in the oracle. Yet I must go on living day to day anyhow. I will go and find the small. Live unseen, at any rate, until some later time when...
In any case, he said goodbye to his wife and left his house. But today, he did not go to the Nippon Times building as usual.
What about relaxation? Drive to Golden Gate Park with its zoo and fish. Visit where things who cannot think, nonetheless, enjoy. Time. It is a long trip for the pedicab, and it gives me more time to perceive, if that can be said. But trees and zoo are not personal. I must clutch at human life. This has made me into a child, although that could be good. I could make it good.
The pedicab driver pumped along Kearney Street toward downtown San Francisco.
Ride cable car,
Mr. Togomi thought suddenly.
Happiness in clearest, almost tear-jerking voyage. Object that should have vanished in 1900 but is oddly yet extant.
He dismissed the pedicab, walked along the sidewalk toward the nearest cable tracks.
Perhaps, he thought, I can never go back to the Nippon Times building with its stink of death. My career over, but just as well. A replacement can be found by the Board of Trade Mission Activities.
But Togomi still walks, exists, recalling every detail. So nothing is accomplished.
In any case, the war, Operation Dandelion, will sweep us all away, no matter what we are doing at the time. Our enemy, alongside whom we fought in the last war. What good did it do us? We should have fought them, possibly, or permitted them to lose, assisted their enemies, the United States, Britain, Russia. Hopeless, wherever one looks. The oracle, enigmatic, Perhaps it has withdrawn from the world of man in sorrow. The sages leaving.
We have entered a moment when we are alone. We cannot get assistance, as before.
Well, Mr. Tagomi thought, perhaps that too is good, or can be made good. One must still try to find the way.
He boarded the California Street cable car, rode all the way to the end of the line. He even hopped out and assisted in turning the cable car around on its wooden turntable. That, of all experiences in the city, had the most meaning for him, customarily. Now, the effect languished. He felt the void even more acutely, due to the vitiation here of all places. Naturally, he rode back. But a formality, he realized as he watched the streets, buildings, traffic pass in reverse of before. Near Stockton, he rose to get off. But at the stop, when he started to descend, the conductor hailed him.
Your briefcase, sir. Thank you.
He had left it on the cable car. Reaching up, he accepted it, then bowed as the cable car clanged into motion.
Very valuable briefcase contents, he thought. Priceless Colt 44 collector's item carried within. Now kept within easy reach constantly, in case vengeful hooligans of SD should try to repay me as individual. One never knows.
And yet, Mr. Tagomi felt that this new procedure, despite all that had occurred, was neurotic.
I should not yield to it,
he told himself once again as he walked along carrying the briefcase.
Compulsion, obsession, phobia.
But he could not free himself.
It in my grip, I in it, he thought. Have I then lost my delighted attitude? He asked himself. Is all instinct perverted from the memory of what I did? All collecting damaged, not merely attitude toward this one item? Mainstay of my life. Area, alas, where I dwelt with such relish.
Hailing a pedicab, he directed the driver to Montgomery Street and Robert Childen's shop.
Let us find out. One thread left, connecting me with the voluntary. I possibly could manage my anxious proclivities by a ruse. Trade the gun in on more historicity-sanctioned item. This gun, for me, has too much subjective history. All of the wrong kind. But that ends with me. No one else can experience it from the gun. Within my psyche only. Free myself, he decided with excitement. When the gun goes, it all leaves. The cloud of the past. For it is not merely in my psyche. It is, as has always been said in the theory of historicity, within the gun as well. An equation between us.
He reached the store.
Where I have dealt so much, he observed as he paid the driver. Both business and private.
Carrying the briefcase, he quickly entered. There, at the cash register, Mr. Childen, polishing with cloth some artifact.
Mr. Tagomi,
Childen said with a bow.
Mr. Childen.
He too bowed.
What a surprise. I am overcome.
Childen put down the object and cloth. Around the corner of the counter he came. Usual ritual, the greeting, etc. Yet, Mr. Tagomi felt the man today somehow different. Rather muted.
An improvement, he decided. Always a trifle loud, shrill, skipping about with agitation. But this might well be a bad omen. Mr. Childen,
Mr. Tagomi said, placing his briefcase on the counter and unzipping it.
I wish to trade in an item bought several years ago. You do that, I recollect.
Yes, Mr. Childen said. Depending on condition, for instance.
He watched alertly.
Colt 44 revolver,
Mr. Tagomi said. They were both silent, regarding the gun as it lay in its open teakwood box with its carton of partly consumed ammunition.
Shade colder by Mr. Tilden.
Ah, Mr. Tagomi realized. Well, so be it. You are not interested, Mr. Tagomi said.
No, sir,
Mr. Tilden said in a stiff voice.
I will not press it.
He did not feel any strength.
I yield. Yin, the adaptive, receptive, holds sway in me. I fear...
Forgive me, Mr. Tagomi.
Mr. Tagomi bowed, replaced the gun, ammunition, box, in his briefcase.
Destiny, I must keep this thing.
You seem quite disappointed, Mr. Tilden said.
You notice.
He was perturbed. Had he let his inner world out for all to view? He shrugged. Certainly it was so.
Was there a special reason why you wanted to trade that item in?
Mr. Tilden said.
No,
he said, once more concealing his personal world, as should be. Mr. Tilden hesitated, then said,
I wonder if that did emanate from my store. I do not carry that item.
I am sure,
Mr. Tagomi said.
But it does not matter. I accept your decision. I am not offended.
Sure, Tilden said. Allow me to show you what has come in. Are you free for a moment?
Mr. Tagomi felt within him the old stirring.
Something of unusual interest?
Come, sir.
Tilden led the way across the store. Mr. Tagomi followed. Within a locked glass case, on trays of black velvet, lay small metal swirls, shapes that merely hinted rather than were. They gave Mr. Tagomi a queer feeling as he stooped to study.
I show these ruthlessly to each of my customers, Robert Tilden said. Sir, do you know what these are?
Jewelry, it appears,
Mr. Tagomi said, noticing a pin.
These are American-made. Yes, of course, but, sir, these are not old.
Mr. Tagomi glanced up.
Sir, these are the new.
Robert Childen's white, somewhat drab features were disturbed by passion.
This is the new life of my country, sir. The beginning in the form of tiny, imperishable seeds. Of beauty.
With due interest, Mr. Tagomi took time to examine in his own hands several of the pieces.
Yes, there is something new which animates these, he decided. The law of Tao is born out here. When yin lies everywhere, the first stirring of light is suddenly alive in the darkest depths. We are all familiar. We have seen it happen before, as I see it here now. And yet for me they are just scraps. I cannot become rapt as Mr. R. Tilden here. Unfortunately, for both of us. But that is the case.
Quite lovely,
he murmured, laying down the pieces. Mr. Tilden said in a forceful voice,
Sir, it does not occur at once.
Pardon?
The new view in your heart.
You are converted, Mr. Tagomi said. I wish I could be. I am not.
He bowed.
Another time,
Mr. Tilden said, accompanying him to the entrance of the store. He made no move to display any alternative items, Mr. Tagomi noticed.
Your certitude is in questionable taste, Mr. Tagomi said. It seems to press untowardly.
Mr. Tilden did not cringe.
Forgive me, he said. But I am correct. I sense accurately in these the contracted germ of the future.
So be it, Mr. Tagomi said. But your Anglo-Saxon fanaticism does not appeal to me.
Nevertheless, he felt a certain renewal of hope. His own hope, in himself.
Good day,
he bowed.
I will see you again one of these days. we can perhaps examine your prophecy.
Mr. Tilden bowed, saying nothing. Carrying his briefcase with the Colt 44 within, Mr. Togomi departed.
I go out as I came in, he reflected. Still seeking. Still without what I need if I am to return to the world. What if I had bought one of those odd, indistinct items? Kept it, re-examined, contemplated. Would I have subsequently, through it, found my way back? I doubt it. Those are for him, not me. And yet, even if one person finds his way, that means there is a way, even if I personally fail to reach it. I envy him.
Turning, Mr. Togomi started back toward the store. There in the doorway stood Mr. Tilden regarding him. He had not gone back in.
Sir, Mr. Togomi said, I will buy one of those, whichever you select. I have no faith, but I am currently grasping at straws.
He followed Mr. Tilden through the store once more to the glass case.
I do not believe. I will carry it about with me, looking at it at regular intervals, once every other day, for instance. After 2 months, if I do not see...
You may return it for full credit, Mr. Tilden said.
Thank you,
Mr. Togomi said. He felt better.
Sometimes one must try anything, he decided. It is no disgrace. On the contrary, it is a sign of wisdom, of recognizing the situation. This will calm you, Mr. Tilden said.
He laid out a single small silver triangle ornamented with hollow drops, black beneath, bright and light-filled above.
Thank you, Mr. Togomi said.
By pedicab, Mr. Togomi journeyed to Portsmouth Square, a little open park on the slope above Kearney Street overlooking the police station. He seated himself on a bench in the sun. Pigeons walked along the paved paths in search of food. On other benches, shabby men read the newspaper or dozed. Here and there, others lay on the grass, nearly asleep. Bringing from his pocket the paper bag marked with the name of Mr. R. Childen's store, Mr. Togomi sat holding the paper bag with both hands, warming himself. Then he opened the bag and lifted out his new possession for inspection in solitude, here in this little grass and path park of old men. He held the squiggle of silver, reflection of the midday sun, like box-top cereal trinket, sent away acquired Jack Armstrong magnifying mirror. Or, he gazed down into it. Om, as the Brahmins say. Shrunk spot in which all is captured. Both, at least in hint, the size, the shape. He continued to inspect dutifully.
Will it come, as Mr. R. Childen prophesied? 5 minutes. 10 minutes. I sit as long as I can. Time, alas, will make us sell it short. What is it I hold while there is still time? Forgive me, Mr. Togomi thought in the direction of the squiggle. Pressure on us always to rise and act.
Regretfully, he began to put the thing away back in its bag. One final hopeful glance. He again scrutinized with all that he had.
Like child, he told himself. Imitate the innocence and faith. On seashore, pressing randomly found shell to head, hearing in its blabber the wisdom of the sea.
This, with eye replacing ear.
Enter me, and inform what has been done, what it means, why. Compression of understanding into one finite squiggle. Asking too much, and so get nothing. Listen, he said sotto voce to the squiggle. Sales warranty promised much. If I shake it violently, like old recalcitrant watch,
He did so, up and down.
Or like dice in Critical Game. Awaken the deity inside. Peradventure, he sleepeth. Or he is on a journey.
Titillating heavy irony by Prophet Elijah.
Or he is pursuing.
Mr. Tagomi violently shook the silver squiggle up and down in his clenched fist once more.
Call him louder.
Again, he scrutinized.
You little thing. You are empty, he thought. Curse at it, he told himself. Frighten it. My patience is running out, he said sotto voce. And what then? Fling you in the gutter? Breathe on it? Shake it? Breathe on it? Win me the game.
He laughed.
Adulpated involvement, here in warm sunlight. Spectacle to whoever comes along. Peeking about guiltily now, but no one saw. Old men snoozing. Measure of relief there.
Tried everything, he realized.
Pleaded, contemplated, threatened, philosophized at length. What else can be done? Could I but stay here? It is denied me. Opportunity will perhaps occur again. And yet, as W.S. Gilbert says, such an opportunity will not occur again. Is that so? I feel it to be so. When I was a child, I thought as a child. But now I have put away childish things. Now I must seek in other realms. I must keep after this object in new ways. I must be scientific, exhaust by logical analysis every entree, systematically, in classic Aristotelian laboratory manner.
He put his finger in his right ear to shut off traffic and all other distracting noises. Then he tightly held the silver triangle, shellwise, to his left ear. No sound. No roar of simulated ocean. In actuality, interior blood motion noises. Not even that.
Then what other sense might apprehend mystery? Hearing of no use, evidently.
Mr. Tagomi shut his eyes and began fingering every bit of surface on the item. Not touch. His fingers told him nothing. Smell. He put the silver close to his nose and inhaled. Metallic faint odor, but it conveyed no meaning. Taste. Opening his mouth, he sneaked the silver triangle within, popped it in like a cracker, but of course refrained from chewing. No meaning. Only bitter, hard, cold thing. He again held it in his palm. Back at last to seeing. Highest ranking of the senses. Greek scale of priority. He turned the silver triangle each and every way. He viewed it from every extra REM standpoint.
What do I see? He asked himself. Due to long, patient, painstaking study, what is clue of truth that confronts me in this object? Yield, he told the silver triangle. Cough up arcane secret. Like frog pulled from depths, he thought. Clutched in fist, given command to declare what lies below in the watery abyss. But here the frog does not even mock. It strangles silently, becomes stone or clay or mineral, inert, passes back to the rigid substance familiar in its tomb world. Metal is from the earth, he thought as he scrutinized. From below. From that realm which is the lowest, the most dense. Land of trolls and caves. Dank. Always dark. Yin world. In its most melancholy aspect. World of corpses, decay, and collapse. Of feces. All that has died, slipping and disintegrating back down, layer by layer. The demonic world of the immutable. The time that was.
And yet, in the sunlight,
the silver triangle glittered. It reflected light.
Fire, Mr. Tagomi thought. Not dank or dark object at all. Not heavy, weary, but pulsing with life. The High Realm. Aspect of Yang. Empyrean. Ethereal. As befits work of art. Yes, that is artist's job. Takes mineral rock from dark, silent earth, transforms it into shining, light-reflecting form from sky. Has brought the dead to life. Corpse turned to fiery display. The past had yielded to the future. Which are you? He asked the silver squiggle. Dark dead yin or brilliant living yang?
In his palm, the silver squiggle danced and blinded him. He squinted, seeing now only the play of fire.
Body of yin, soul of yang. Metal and fire unified. The outer and inner. Microcosmos in my palm. What is the space which this speaks of? Vertical ascent? To heaven? Of time? Into the light world of the mutable. Yes, this thing has disgorged its spirit. Light. And my attention is fixed. I can't look away. Spellbound by mesmerizing, shimmering surface which I can no longer control. No longer free to dismiss. Now talk to me, he told it. Now that you have snared me, I want to hear your voice issuing from the blinding clear white light, such as we expect to see only in the Bardo Todol afterlife existence. But I do not have to wait for death, for the decomposition of my animus as it wanders in search of a new womb. All the terrifying and beneficent deities, we will bypass them. And the smoky lights as well. And the couples in coitus. Everything except this light. I am ready to face without terror. Notice, I do not blench. I feel the hot winds of karma driving me. Nevertheless, I remain here. My training was correct. I must not shrink from the clear white light, for if I do, I will once more re-enter the cycle of birth and death, never knowing freedom, never obtaining release. The veil of Maya will fall once more if I...
The light disappeared. He held the dull silver triangle only. Shadow had cut off the sun. Mr. Tagomi glanced up. Tall, blue-suited policeman standing by his bench, smiling.
Eh?
Mr. Tagomi said, startled.
I was just watching you work that puzzle. The policeman started on along the path.
Puzzle? Mr. Tagomi echoed. Not a puzzle.
Isn't that one of those little puzzles you have to take apart? My kid has a whole lot of them. Some are hard.
The policeman passed on. Mr. Tagomi thought,
spoiled. My chance at Nirvana. Gone. Interrupted by that white barbarian Neanderthal yank. That subhuman supposing I worked a child's puerile toy.
Rising from the bench, he took a few steps unsteadily.
Must calm down. Dreadful low-class jingoistic racist invectives. Unworthy of me. Incredible, unredemptive passions clashing in my breast.
He made his way through the park.
Keep moving, he told himself. Catharsis in motion.
He reached periphery of park. Sidewalk, Kearney Street. Heavy, noisy traffic. Mr. Tagomi halted at the curb. No pedicabs. He walked along the sidewalk instead. He joined the crowd.
Never can get one when you need it. God, what is that?
He stopped, gaped at hideous misshapen thing on skyline.
Like nightmare of roller coaster suspended, blotting out view.
enormous construction of metal and cement in air.
Mr. Togomi turned to a passerby, a thin man in rumpled suit.
What is that?
He demanded, pointing. The man grinned.
Awful, ain't it? That's the Embarcadero Freeway. A lot of people think it stinks up the view.
I never saw it before,
Mr. Togomi said.
You're lucky,
the man said and went on.
Mad dream, Mr. Togomi thought. Must wake up. Where are the pedicabs today?
He began to walk faster.
Whole vista has dull, smoky, tomb-world cast. Smell of burning. Dim gray buildings. Sidewalk. Peculiar hearth tempo in people. And still no pedicabs. Cab!
He shouted as he hurried along. Hopeless. Only cars and buses. Cars like brutal big crushers, all unfamiliar in shape. He avoided seeing them, kept his eyes straight ahead.
Distortion of my optic perception of particularly sinister nature. A disturbance affecting my sense of space. Horizon twisted out of line. Like lethal astigmatism striking without warning. Must obtain respite. Ahead, a dingy lunch counter. Only whites within, all supping.
Mr. Togomi pushed open the wooden swinging doors.
Smell of coffee. Grotesque jukebox in corner blaring out.
He winced and made his way to the counter.
All stools taken by whites.
Mr. Togomi exclaimed. Several whites looked up. But none departed their places. None yielded their stools to him. They merely resumed supping.
I insist,
Mr. Togomi said loudly to the first white. He shouted in the man's ear. The man put down his coffee mug and said,
Watch it, Tojo.
Mr. Togomi looked to the other whites. All watched with hostile expressions. And none stirred.
Bardo todal existence, Mr. Togomi thought. Hot winds blowing me who knows where. This is vision. Of what? Can the animus endure this? Yes, the Book of the Dead prepares us. After death, we seem to glimpse others, but all appear hostile to us. One stands isolated, unsuccored wherever one turns. The terrible journey, and always the realms of suffering, rebirth, ready to receive the fleeing, demoralized spirit. The delusions.
He hurried from the lunch counter. The doors swung together behind him. He stood once more on the sidewalk.
Where am I? Out of my world, my space and time. The silver triangle disoriented me. I broke from my moorings and hence stand on nothing. So much for my endeavor. Lesson to me forever. One seeks to contravene one's perceptions. Why? So that one can wander utterly lost without signposts or guide? This hypnagogic condition. Attention faculty diminished so that twilight state obtains. World seen merely in symbolic archetypal aspect. Totally confused with unconscious material. Typical of hypnosis-induced somnambulism. Must stop this dreadful gliding among shadows. Refocus concentration and thereby restore ego center.
He felt in his pockets for the silver triangle.
Gone. Left the thing on the bench in the park with briefcase. Catastrophe.
Crouching, he ran back up the sidewalk to the park. Dozing bums eyed him in surprise as he hurried up the path. There, the bench. And leaning against it still, his briefcase. No sign of the silver triangle. He hunted. Yes, fallen through to grass, it lay partly hidden. Where he had hurled it in rage. He reseated himself, panting for breath.
Focus on silver triangle once more. He told himself when he could breathe. Scrutinize it forcefully and count. At 10, utter startling noise. Erwache, for instance. Idiotic daydreaming of fugal type, he thought. Emulation of more noxious aspects of adolescence, rather than the clear-headed pristine innocence of authentic childhood. Just what I deserve, anyhow. Or my own fault. No intention by Mr. R. Tilden or Artisans. My own greed to blame. One cannot compel understanding to come.
He counted slowly, aloud, and then jumped to his feet.
Goddamn stupidity, he said sharply. Mists cleared?
He peeped about.
Diffusion subsided, in all probability. Now one appreciates St. Paul's incisive word choice. Seen through glass darkly, not a metaphor, but astute reference to optical distortion. We really do see astigmatically, in fundamental sense. Our space and our time creations of our own psyche, and when these momentarily falter, like acute disturbance of middle ear. Occasionally we list eccentrically, all sense of balance gone.
He reseated himself, put the silver squiggle away in his coat pocket, sat holding his briefcase on his lap.
What I must do now, he told himself, is go and see if that malignant construction, what did the man call it, Embarcadero Freeway, if it is still palpable.
But he felt afraid to.
And yet, he thought, I can't merely sit here. I have loads to lift. As old U.S. folk expression has it, jobs to be done. Dilemma.
Two small Chinese boys came scampering noisily along the path. A flock of pigeons fluttered up. The boys paused. Mr. Tagomi called,
You, young fellows!
He dug into his pocket.
Come here!
The two boys guardedly approached.
Here's a dime!
Mr. Tagomi tossed them a dime. The boys scrambled for it.
Go down to Kearney Street and see if there are any pedicabs. Come back and tell me.
Will you give us another dime?
One of the boys said.
When we get back?
Yes,
Mr. Tagomi said.
But tell me the truth.
The boys raced off along the path.
If there are not, Mr. Tagomi thought, I would be well advised to retire to secluded place and kill myself.
He clutched his briefcase.
Still have the weapon. No difficulty there.
The boys came tearing back.
Six!
One of them yelled.
I counted six. I counted five,
the other boy gasped. Mr. Tagomi said,
You're sure they were pedicabs? You distinctly saw the drivers pedaling?
Yes, sir,
the boys said together. He gave each boy a dime. They thanked him and ran off.
Back to office and job,
Mr. Tagomi thought. He rose to his feet, gripping the handle of his briefcase.
Duty calls. Customary day, once again.
Once more he walked down the path, to the sidewalk.
Cab!
He called. From the traffic a pedicab appeared. The driver came to a halt at the curb, his dark face glistening, chest heaving.
Yes, sir! Take me to the Nippon Times building,
Mr. Tagomi ordered. He ascended to the seat and made himself comfortable. Pedaling furiously, the pedicab driver moved out among the other cabs and cars. It was slightly before noon when Mr. Tagomi reached the Nippon Times building. From the main lobby, he instructed a switchboard operator to connect him with Mr. Ramsey upstairs.
Tagomi here,
he said, when the connection was complete.
Good morning, sir. I am relieved. Not seeing you, I apprehensively telephoned your home at 10 o'clock, but your wife said you had left for unknown parts.
Mr. Tagomi said,
Has the mess been cleared?
No sign remains.
Beyond dispute?
My word, sir.
Satisfied, Mr. Tagomi hung up and went to take the elevator. Upstairs, as he entered his office, he permitted himself a momentary search. Rim of his vision.
No sign, as was promised. He felt relief. No one would know who hadn't seen.